南無妙法蓮華経。南無妙法蓮華経。
Hello, everyone. I hope you're doing well, that you're in good health and secure, safe. Thank you right off the bat. First of all, for your practice, Namo Myo Renge Kyo, I'm super grateful for that. Keep that going. One way to keep it going is to keep feeling inspired by it. Hopefully, this channel is part of your study. I mean, you're going to do your own reading and your own research into terms and what have you. Beware, there's a lot of information out there, and it's not all correct or a lot of misguided information. But so just be aware that you're dealing with other people's sensibilities, cultures, misinformation. Yeah. And since I'm on that subject, let me go ahead and broach this. I have been toying for quite some time of doing a deep dive into Nichiren's mandalas. And I actually feel pretty strongly about this, that it is, I think it's a grave error. But I also think it is a manipulative error that so many groups, sects, avenues of study of Lotus Sutra, Shakyamuni's Lotus Sutra, Buddhist practice is disseminated, taught by groups assuming the moniker of Nichiren and Nichiren's doctrine, and that they absolutely do not broach the subject of the evolution of Nichiren's mandala. It doesn't even qualify as taboo. They simply don't seem to want you to know, because that would give you critical thinking skills. And we don't want that. Right off the bat, that's a big clue as to who you're studying with. Why would they hold back any effort? Did Nichiren hold back? Hell no. He dug deep, right? And who digs deeper on any subject than Shakyamuni? I mean, Buddhism is digging deep. The nature of the mind, the nature of life itself, what is birth, what is death, what is energy, what is time, what is space. I mean, Buddhism digs into every nook and cranny, doesn't it? You know, albeit through stories and examples, it's the scholarship of the practice. And that's one of the reasons study is so important. Because the more you know, the more profound your understanding, the more conviction, the more resolve, so that every time you sit in front of your butsudan, stare down that mandala, and invoke, open up your gohonzon to your Buddha experience, it's meaningful. Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. It's not just because every chant has with it this huge, profound database of conviction. This is what keeps your practice fresh, exciting, anticipatory. Buddha-ness becomes like arriving at the party. It's exciting. It's wide-eyed. That's the attitude we want. Oh, yeah, there's that word again. Attitude and intent. How can you even know what your intent is if your attitude is going to sleep? I am talking about Nichiren's lifetime of practice and his evolution, his depth of understanding, even as we witness him spreading, propagating the Lotus Sutra throughout his life, he is more and more convinced. We watch this arc. I've done videos on all the Go Show. And we witness Nichiren's evolution of profundity in Shakyamuni's teachings of the Lotus Sutra, through Tendai, through Dengyo, through Miao Lo, through Nagarjuna, through Vasubandhu. He goes through all of it. And with every year, you can see him gelling certain aspects, even though there's thousands of teachings. Buddhism really is a simple thought. But that thought is chased to its very origin. I mean, it took Shakyamuni about 12 years of deep, committed searching to the edge of his own life. No exaggeration. And there's lots you can read about all of that. So how much conviction did he need that he had reached the answer? How many times in your life have you thought, I understand the world, only 5 years later to think, what a fool I was, right? Shakyamuni didn't arrive at Buddha and 5 years later decide, oh, scratch that. That would be tragically hilarious, yeah? What are the term? Tragicomic? No, he spent about 50 years of his life after he finally attained that aha, training others how to get there. Nichiren, for all of his scholarship, spent his life studying Shakyamuni's guidance, teachings, dharma, expositions. And although he grasped it, the more he dug into it, the more he was challenged to have to bolster his position, the more he got new, refreshing insights and tools of propagation to understand this is what Shakyamuni was saying about our time that I am in. This is how we end up with a mandala to begin with. But the mandala starts out with, I don't want to say humble, but simple beginnings. He started offering them to key disciples, lay people, and so forth, who were not only practicing for themselves, but for others or each other. All of them had Namo Myoho Renge Kyo. That was solid. That's almost spelled out verbatim in the Treasure Tower chapter of the Lotus Sutra. Nichiren was just embodying that and saying, this is what he's talking about. This Gohonzon of mind, here it is. Here's what it would look like as some kind of environmental reflector for you to, right? Because self and environment, the primary illusion is that they're separate. But the environment is always our set of, that's our house of mirrors. It's all reflections of us. So let me create a reflector that shows you your gate, your gohodzan to Buddha. And he started handing them out. Not, you know, like pamphlets, but they were special documents, a commitment by Nichiren to assist someone in perceiving that transcendent mind. That, what was it called in that chapter we were reading in the Vimalakirti? Beyond comprehension. Right? But that mandala didn't come, like the one behind me, that didn't come out fully formed. It was the product of years of development, which represents now in its final forms in the last few years of his life as not just a mandala for Shijokingo or Togomitsu or one of his closest disciples. It became such a gel of the Lotus Sutra and our age and time that its final formations were universal. This mandala was created by Nietzsche not for just a person, but all persons, all minds. So it had to cover the entirety of what it is to enter that gate to Buddhahood. All of the concepts of Shakyamuni's teachings, which are contained in the Lotus Sutra. The Lotus Sutra stands on top of all the previous 40-some years of teaching. Conceptually, it's all in the Lotus Sutra, albeit a new way, a new methodology of simply attaining Buddhahood for oneself by one's own actions. And there it is, that mandala, signed by Nichiren. This is my scholarship, my doctrine of Shakyamuni's teaching of Lotus Sutra. Here's the Lotus Sutra, and here's the primary practice. Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, treasure tower, right down the center. Where's that treasure tower? It's not on the mandala. That's a reflection. The gohonzon is in your mind. Nichiren's words, never seek this gohonzon outside yourself. Right? So this is the culmination, the gelling of his whole tools of enlightenment, as prescribed by Shakyamuni's teachings. That's quite phenomenal. And in our world of distractions today, to have something to focus on that's part and parcel of our physical universe, we don't have to dream it. We have something physical. And if you learn to focus on like the Myoho characters, as you chant, time, you'll see time slip by. You'll stop thinking about what's in the kitchen and what you're hungry for. If you really focus your mind on Buddha-ness, all of that stuff recedes and you open your gohonzon, and now there's a relationship going between all of your human senses, this perfect reflection of enlightenment, and the attainment, the awakening in your mind. Everything else goes away, recedes. It's no longer important. You get tunnel vision. I've described that many times, yeah? We call it fusing with gohonzon, yeah? And then we have these groups, and I get asked this question all the time. Well, isn't my old SGI mandala good enough? Oh, I have one from NSA, or I have one from, you know, this old guy who made his own. I can't do anything about your emotional attachments to things. because that's what they are, attachments, entanglements. But let me say this and see if it doesn't sound reasonable to you. When somebody asks me, well, I have a mandala from the 30th abbot of such and such sect. Should I get one? Because there's now, I don't know, 60, let's say there's 62 abbots in a row, you know, at this sect. Is the one from the current abbot better than the 30th abbot? Or is the older mandala I have from the 46th abbot more valid than the new one? Because it's closer to Nichiren. I don't know, whatever contorted thinking goes on in people. What you need to understand is when this man, because he's nothing special, I mean, it's special that he's trained and gone into scholarship and all that. Yeah. But he's a man or a woman, but very few of those, haven't found one, but the possibility is there. You want to become an abbot of this school, I welcome you. You just got to show me the scholarship. It's a merit-based thing, isn't it? But my point is, those mandalas aren't Nichirens. The 30th abbot, or the 46th, or the 56th, or the first or second, they are copying Nichiren's mandala. Okay, great. I can do that. It's in the Lotus Sutra. Copy, recite, read. Yeah, copying is important. It's a ritual of practice, of training the mind. Yeah? But if Bob creates a copy of the mandala and he signs it Bob, January 34th, 1989, and he puts that on the mandala, what the hell does that have to do with my enlightenment? What the heck does that have to do with Buddha-ness? Bob? Yeah, I'm now focusing on Bob and some date in 1989. No, that's, I'm not practicing Bob's Buddhism or doctrine or tool. I'm practicing Nichiren's enlightenment of Shakyamuni's teachings of the Lotus Sutra. Nichiren is my mentor, not you, Bob. How did you usurp Nichiren's authority and scholarship? You may be a great scholar, but I ain't practicing your doctrine. I'm practicing Nichiren's. Get the hell out of the way. Now, I get that we have a great privilege today with digital technology. We can take an ancient document, hundreds of years old, and we can actually create higher contrast so that it really pops. Get a black and white copy of an original document actually inscribed by Nichiren, and the paper is degraded and yellowed. But with digital technology, we can copy that as though it was an original document. Better than original, because we'll have white paper and black letters. And we can take that digital copy, and hell, if you're a purist, you could make that, blue paper with gold characters. The point is the inscription, the signature, the characters, the stylized script, all of it is Nichiren's hand. Not Bob's or Betty's or John's or Mustafa or anyone else. Now, there is a workshop, and then I'll shut up about this. There's a workshop of scholars that have books available online. I mean, books. I mean, actual books, okay? And everywhere I've looked, there is scholarship indicating that there are 125 still extant, some of them very fragile, Nichiren-inscribed mandala. And there are pictures of these very simple, little scribbly ones. And you can see the evolution over time, over Nichiren's teaching career, his lifetime. And in the last few years, they really start to gel into one larger form where they're universal. It is said, and I've read it, information being what it is, that Nichiren was actually buried with one of these, like the one behind me, with him. Whether that's true or not, I haven't seen definitive evidence of that. But the point is, in those last few years, he had fully developed this mandala. And I picked one of those that seemed to be the clearest and it fully evolved. And I downloaded a very high resolution TIFF image of it, if you know what TIFF is. And I made PDFs of it, and I made bitmaps of it, and I made... Anyway, I have made this Nichiren inscribed digital copy of his work available to you through the cafepress.com/gohonzon store. I tried to keep the price down as much as possible, but you know, printing to order, there's cost involved. They're not out of reach. You can order them framed if you don't have the availability of a proper butsudan. At least you can have it framed, so it's protected, and it'll be matted and well preserved, and you can hang that on your wall, or you can just buy a paper version of it and enshrine it yourself. I've added some gold handmade paper pattern around it to make it pop a little bit more. As long as what you do is respectful and not distracting of the mandala itself, you're cool. But you're practicing with a Nichiren mandala. That's our mentor. That's our teacher. But see, all of this, who teaches that? Unless you have the wherewithal or the questioning mind to doubt everybody, natural skeptic like I am, you got to go down some rabbit holes. A lot of these rabbit holes that I've gone down on the internet have disappeared. Wonder who's doing that. I won't say it, but you got to know who I'm talking about. They are a specific group who have money coming out of their ears, and they are working diligently to make themselves the only source of information. Abhorrent organization. Anyway, there is only one mandala to use. There is only one, Nichiren's. These others are posing as Nichiren's replacement. Like, well, I got the specialness sauce, and so I'm like Nichiren today. Oh, you arrogant... You're not my teacher. Plus, what you spouse is complete, you know what. So, I'm getting heated up. I'm going to stop talking about it. Just know that all of this is about a future video, set of videos. I will reference this workshop. So, you can go look at them online, search for yourself, buy your book, their books, read of their own analysis. I'm not saying that they're perfect Buddhists. They're just scholars investigating this thing, this history of Nichiren mandalas. But that's okay. It's still valid academic research. At very least, when you're practicing to your mandala, know what you're doing. This information should be freely available to any Buddhist. Yeah? What is going on? Don't be blind. It's your practice. It's your Buddha-ness. Don't you want to do it the best that you can? Doesn't it make sense that you lessen the obstacles for your enlightenment? Yeah? All right. So we've started the entering the gate of non-dualism. Mouthful, yeah? So now the bodhisattva, wonderful arm. It makes you wonder what his arm looks like, yeah? I'm very visual. The bodhisattva mind and the voice hearer mind constitute dualism. Okay. But if one regards the mind as empty in form, like a conjured phantom, then there is no bodhisattva mind and no voice hearer mind. In this way, one can enter the gate of non-dualism. And I would say to bodhisattva, wonderful arm, yeah, why stop there? Of all the, what is it? It's over 8 billion now minds on earth. The moment you put an S after the word mind, dualism. Yeah, everybody perceives everything through their own filters to experience that thing in a very personal, entangled, attached way. That is dualism. Samsara is dualism. But what's interesting, he says, when you perceive the mind as empty in form. That's interesting, because let's dissect that a little bit for a moment. I suppose it is quite natural to think of your mind, my mind, as different things. As I was just saying, we all perceive and experience all the same things in the world, albeit in our own way, our own huge database of influences, predilections, prejudices, understandings. Yeah. But let's think a little bit deeper here. Could it be that what we call mind is a processor of information and not the information itself? And this is where we start to understand the nine consciousnesses. Again, please go watch that video. There's a few of them that deal with the nine consciousnesses. There was one, the most recent one, I think, says Myoho Renge Kyo, nine consciousnesses, and something else. They're equivalent, somewhat, terms. But nine consciousnesses is in the title. So you can just go to the home page of this channel by the little magnifying glass in the middle, not the top search, that little magnifying glass in the middle, and type in nine consciousnesses, or just consciousnesses, and you'll get a result set of videos about the nine consciousnesses. And I bring this up because this repository of ideas about, formed about things, this memory base of energies with actions taken, not memories like the visual memories you have of your vacation 3 years ago, but memories of your tendencies and conditions. Memories of the way you experience things. we have a consciousness layer that's all about that. Conventional psychology would call that part of our unconsciousness, or more accurately, our epistemology. Belief systems inculcated on belief systems inculcated on belief systems that come and express themselves without our realizing how we experience something the way that we experience it. In the same way, and I've used this example before, if you're bitten by a dog when you're 3 years old and it traumatizes you, you may, you know, years later, your mom doesn't talk to you about it, your dad doesn't, or your sibling, whatever. Nobody's there to remind you, remember when that dog bit you? If nobody ever said anything to you about being bitten by a dog, your experience of it, and 30 years later, you're walking along the street and you heard a dog bark, that visceral reaction that you have, that moment of confusion, yeah, that comes from that event. You've stored your understanding of dog bark. Or maybe it's not the bark. Maybe it's the way some dogs attack their food. And maybe that frightens you, right? And somebody says, how does it frighten you that my dog's eating? I don't know. I don't know. It scares me. That's your Amala consciousness. Yeah? It's made decisions, entanglements from your tendencies and conditions that drive your perception of the world. It's important to know this because when we chant, we're chipping away at that. We're getting those obstacles out of the way so that we train that consciousnesses, all the consciousnesses, and if you watch the video, you'll understand, by virtue of directing them to Buddha-ness. We don't erase those experiences. We modify those experiences to a more humanistic, a more life-affirming understanding, employment in our perception of the world. That's what we're doing in our practice. This is why we continuously doing it morning and evening or whenever. Because we're modifying this huge database. That ultimately, as we know from the study of the profundity of Shakyamuni's teaching, begins the moment the universe begins. We have tendencies and conditions built into our karmic freight train of energies acted upon and manifesting that began their journey in manifestation from the moment the universe first started expansion or moved into or convert. Whether you believe in a big bang or inflation theory or whatever, the universe started from a very basic point and has been expanding, exploding, expressing its potential ever since. And every energetic source material that is here now started then. So understand karma. It's simply the energy of the universe manifesting itself. And your little pocket of energies, vast as it is, has countless tendencies and conditions in it. And we experience and select from only a few, but they're all there. This is the amazing aspect of Buddha-ness. Is that we become much more perceptive of that entire freight train within the concept, the context of the universe. But at the same time, the thing that impedes us from experiencing the full expression of life is the old misperceptions and epistemologies that obfuscate it. And so our practice does two things. You could argue more than two, but basically opens that door to understanding, appreciating, witnessing, experiencing full life, and modifying old entanglements, attachments. It's a two-edged sword, right? So yeah, if you understand that the mind is a processor, an experiencer, an observer, then it itself doesn't have stored mechanisms, stuff. If you have to find storage, it's in the Amala consciousness, and the Amala consciousness, it's not even your brain. That is memories, because that's a stockpile of experiences. But those experiences, they're all colored by the Amala, the tendencies and conditions. You see the separation? One is the dog bite. That's a memory. But how I felt about it, how it confronted me, everything I experienced about it, that's not the brain so much as it is our tendencies and conditions, how we view, how we experience, through what filters do we experience. Oh, here's a new filter. You see? The Bodhisattva Pusha. Pusha is the 23rd of the 28 constellations or stellar mansions of Indian astrology, the constellation under whose influence this bodhisattva was born. Whatever. He says, this is just another bodhisattva asking the question, yeah? Good or not good form a dualism. Good or not good, good or bad. Right, I was talking about this earlier. People talk about good karma, bad karma, no such thing. That's that duality being enforced. That's our disease, that we keep wanting to make things good, bad, this, that. We're obsessed about that because that's how we identify self. That's simple. So he says, good and not good form a dualism. Okay. What's more interesting is how they solve it, right? But if one does not call up either good or not good, but enters into the realm of formless and truly masters it, in this way one may enter the gate of non-dualism. All right. You see how we're all of these bodhisattvas are just finding different ways of saying the same thing. How do you grapple? How do you grapple with a world that you've experienced your whole life as things, as dualism, me, you, this, that, everything is self and other in samsara? How do we learn to train our mind to see that that's the primary illusion? That's where all our stress and anxiety comes from. Well, I want that, but I don't want that. Now that I have this, I might lose this. And Buddhism simply says, you know, if you could just realize that you're not losing or gaining anything, that this is a moment-to-moment process that we're all in. And in that way, there's no differences. There's no this or that. It's all life process. And if you can, when you do that with your mind, there's a natural embrace and letting go. Because everything is yours and nothing is yours. Because you and everything else is just time. Manifestation of life. Wow, this is incredible. Do you want one of these? Whatever. samsarically, I need to eat something. So yeah, give me a cheeseburger. But I'm not attached to that. That was my cheeseburger. How silly is that when you think from this other perspective, yeah? And yet remain here in this samsaric delusion of stuff, but with a different mindset. With a mindset that liberates you from this obsession of having and letting go. And it's a big de-stressor. It's really that simple, guys. Bodhisattva Lion says, blame and reward form a dualism. This word blessing, man, I need to strike it from all these books. You understand why, right? A blessing, especially in Western minds, is something given. In Buddhism, nothing's given to us. We earn it. We earn our enlightenment. We chase it, accomplish it, and live in it. Nobody hands it to us. I say it over and over and over again. Nobody can hand you Buddha. Only you can discover, awaken Buddha, which is, it's already going on. You're just blind to it because you're so attached to everything. How many ways can we say that? So blaming and being rewarded is a dualism. Well, yeah, those very terms are dualism, if you really understand what you're saying. But if one penetrates the true nature here of blame, it is no different from a reward because it's an entanglement. Then you understand the true nature of those things. When one can dispose of forms with this diamond-like wisdom, neither bound nor liberated, one may in this way enter the gate of non-dualism. Okay, not sure about the wording, but I get it. I get what this bodhisattva, this is regurgitating the same idea, but in a different way. Right? And everybody experiences their aha moment differently. So, yay, you found another way to say it. Let's see what the next one is. Bodhisattva Lion Will. He says, presence of outflows of passion and absence of such outflows constitutes a dualism. Okay, so if you experience the world with passions, in other words, desire, attachments, you know, entanglements, or the absence of desire or entanglements. Well, that's a dualism. Okay. I feel like an elementary school teacher going, good boy, Johnny. Yes, good answer. But let's see what he continues with. But if one can grasp the fact that all dharmas are equal, then one will not give rise to the concept of outflows, nor no outflows. One will not be attached to form, nor dwell in formlessness either. In this way, one may enter the gate of non-dualism. Well, that's a slightly more profound view, understanding of the situation, because there is a lot of misleading teaching out there. That the goal of Buddhism is to enter formlessness. And I won't label certain sects or groups, but there's a lot of that. And it can get pretty mystical. People with their astral planes, and there are so many manifestations of this kind of thinking, of if we could just be, not be, then we would be enlightened. But that, let me assure you, that's a crock. That's a complete misreading and understanding of Buddhism. It's not Buddhism. Form and not form are studied in order to nurture the mind to break its voracious appetite for attachment, entanglement, possession. But that doesn't mean that what is being possessed needs to be annihilated. That's missing the point entirely. It's not the thing that's the problem. It's your investment in the thing that's the problem. That's what you're liberating yourself from. Not the thing. Enjoy your pound cake, your cheesecake, your carrot cake. That's what I was talking about the other day. Or your steak, or your skateboard, or each other. Immerse yourself in the joy of being with, but not possessing. Anyone who's ever been in any relationship knows the trouble of possessing. All your stress. Love hurts, right? No, it doesn't. Real love doesn't hurt. What hurts is your misgiven expectations from your ownership, trying to make permanent and static something that is dynamic and gorgeous and beautiful and constantly developing. That hurts. You see, Buddhism is always trying to identify that broken mechanism. Everything is enlightenment all the time, in all its forms. The form ain't the problem. The attachment makes the form permanent or static. That's the problem, because that isn't real. That's a construct you're pushing onto a process that's liberated, wonderful, being. The Bodhisattva Pure Understanding said, the created and the uncreated form a dualism. Yeah, again, we're using the language of earlier teachings. Let's see what he does with it. But if one does away with all enumerations, right? I say differentiations. Then the mind is like empty sky, freed of all obstacles through pure, clean wisdom. In this way, we enter the gate of non-dualism. Well, this is exactly what I was saying earlier. If you understand that your perceiving engine, not your brain, your calculator, your master runner of physical processes, it's vastly important, but it ain't doing this. Your mind is a perceiver. What you do with those perceptions is a function of all your consciousnesses, and they are earthbound consciousnesses. So they want to data, identify, possess, let go, run away from, run toward. That's all tendencies and conditions. If you can, with your mind, suppress, wipe out, convert that massive database that's constantly being updated to look toward the observation rather than the trying to retain cubicle-ize, identify with or without, just observe, then you're freed from that mechanism, are you not? I swear, the more sophisticated our computers become, the more they demand our attention, like a little baby want machine. That's what our computers are becoming now. It's a little scary, actually. Okay, one, maybe two more. The Bodhisattva Narayana said, The worldly and the unworldly form a dualism. Well, again, words, right? What's worldly and what's unworldly? They're both things. If you believe in some flying spaghetti monster, certainly you'd have to say that's unworldly, because there's absolutely no evidence of something, anything, called a flying spaghetti monster, other than the words that concoct a vision for you. And then as soon as you do that, it's a thing. So if you weight that thing like you do this microphone, then you don't perceive the difference, because in your samsaric mind, they're both things, and I can identify with or without them. I believe, I don't believe. You're making decisions about things, and that controls your tendencies and conditions in life. You base a little tiny bit of your life on that. And if somebody says, you're an idiot for believing in a flying spaghetti monster, your feelings get hurt. Or you want to race to prove something. Because entanglements, because attachment, because thing. You've identified with thing. Worldly or unworldly, real or imagined. Say it any way you want. But since the nature of the worldly is empty, I understand it when you say the flying spaghetti monster is an imaginary thing. I grasp that. Most people would. And then they'll tell you whether or not they believe in it. Not relevant. But to say that a worldly thing, like the book I'm reading from, is empty, it bends the melon, yeah? That's the hard part of Buddhism that people struggle with. And you have to go back to, what is a book? How did it come about? What the energies and atoms and molecules are that can constitute a book? And you start to disassemble the reality of bookness as something that is just a temporary manifestation of potentials. And it will disappear. Because it's not a permanent thing. It may last a long time, but that doesn't make it permanent. Not even the universe is permanent. Nothing is. And this is a point Shakyamuni hammered on constantly. But it's a difficult thing to understand. Because we don't want that. We want to say, yeah, eventually it won't be here. But it'll be here in my lifetime. Well, maybe. Maybe. How many people have had their house burned down or been in a tornado or a hurricane? Name 100 different ways this book could disappear. It doesn't just have to degrade and become silt and go back into the ground for it to disappear. The point is, it ain't permanent. Some people just like to argue, yeah? Neither entering into it nor going out of it, neither exceeding or falling, short, in this way one enters the gate of non-dualism. In other words, the whole drama about thingness, the identification with or without it, is the same problem. It's the attachment, the entanglement. I'm liking that word even better than attachment, because it's more an entanglement. It's our relationship with thing. So that's the best one I've read so far. One more. The Bodhisattva Goodwill said, the realm of birth and death and that of nirvana form a dualism. Well, that's the entirety of Buddhism right there, right? But if one sees that the true nature of birth and death, One sees that there is no birth or death, no binding, no unbinding, no birth or burning. In other words, this activity, no extinction, no ceasing of activity. One who understands in this way may thereby enter the gate of non-dualism. Well, I think it's important then, if you're going to read that, to really dive into the meaning of those words. Birth, death, we've already talked about. Death isn't the opposite of life. It's the opposite of birth. Birth is not the opposite of death. In fact, you could play with these words all day long. Birth is death. Death is birth. That's why we talk about rebirth. You have to understand, in Buddhism, time is granular. It's moment to moment to moment to moment to moment. And each moment of a manifestation of this freight train of karma within the context of the karma of the entire universe is just a moment to moment manifestation of potentials. And potentials have a momentum. But in those moments, they're never identical. And that's what proves impermanence. Nothing is permanent. Nothing is permanent from moment to moment. It's just like a wave. And a wave, as it moves, is never identical to the moment it was waving earlier. It is progressing. It has a momentum. Just like your life, my life, the life of flowers, plants, the earth, the universe, the chair, the book. There's a momentum of formations that is moving through time. And it can be influenced or changed. You want proof? Take the book. Take the book and put it in a humid room. Let's say a room, like if you've ever been to an enclosed sport facility where the pool is indoors. You feel it when you walk in the room. There's chlorine in the air. There are certain smells, cleansers, so on and so forth. The air is different. Put this book in that room. Take an identical copy of the book and put it in a computer server room where the temperature is always the same. The humidity is kept very low. And then take the identical book, as identical as it can be, thought you caught me, and keep it on your bookshelf at home, whatever your home, if it's climate control, not climate, whatever. And in 6 months, in 3 years, in 10 years, revisit the condition of the book. And tell me they're all the same. You can tell me, I won't believe you. That's the nature of tendencies and conditions. It permeates everything, every moment, to be actually more accurate. And the manifestations of those moments, the momentum of the energies of the universe, your life, my little dog. Yeah. Sometimes, you know, when I read these sutras, this is a caveat for you guys, back off for a moment. I don't often watch myself, right? I don't run into the house and go, oh, let me watch that video I did last week on this. I know who I am and how I talk, and sometimes it's a little circular. I'm trying to cover every minutia that I can, and I'm confident that however it is I communicate to you guys, that there will be certain words, certain combinations of words, certain insights, certain things I share with you that will perk your attention. Wait a minute, What did you say? Maybe go see that and go, I get that. Right? Because I'm very, my intent is to strengthen your practice and mine. But that doesn't mean that my intent comes through in every word that comes out of my mouth. My intent comes through in your hearing my intent. And it may not be in the words. And so when I go back and I listen to myself, I'm trying to listen to the content. And sometimes I get frustrated with what the hell was I trying to say? And you have to listen to more of it to, oh, now I know what I was talking about. But I've already invested my time in talking about that. So for me, there's very little to get out of listening to myself or scripting, which is why I don't script. Because if I script it, I'm done talking about it. I don't really want to record it, say it again. If I say the same thing again, it was because I'll say it in a different way. Because like life, I'm never the same moment to moment. But when I do, I drink. You see, my mind just goes all over the place. Anyway, all of that is to say that I have great confidence that it is your resolve, your dedication to your practice that is everything here. You're entertaining what I'm talking about. Your desire for enlightenment, your desire to have encouragement for your enlightenment, your desire to satisfy your curiosities about things and sutras and what have you, is all about strengthening your resolve. And somehow, in all of these communications, these videos, these podcasts you can download, I believe there's something either throughout the whole thing or in some particular part that's going to resonate with you. And that is something Shakyamuni realized 3,000 years ago is Sangha. It's Itai Doshin. It's many in body, samsara, but one in mind, Buddha-ness. Yeah. And that process I find not only fascinating, but highly motivating. I hope that this is what you get out of the Sangha that we have. I appreciate your participation more than I can express. For those of you who can support this effort, the website, the bookstore, the mandala store, by your purchases of books, mandalas, or your donations through paypal.com/TLK or, not PayPal, patreon.com/TLK or PayPal through the paypal.me/SifuSylvain. Anything you can do to help keep this going. Of course, I'm incredibly appreciative, but it's about what we do together. The potential of spreading, disseminating Nichiren's doctrine of Shakyamuni's teachings of the Lotus Sutra. The more we expand, the more people we reach, maybe we knock a little less violence out of our spectrum. Maybe we quell tempers. Maybe we open the minds of people who in our age seem to be more and more solidifying in their reactionary, violent kind of thinking, right? They're stagnating into positions instead of just think. Buddhism is about thinking openly. That's where beauty lies. The minute you stultify your thinking, you're dying. You're becoming a nail. I really believe that our efforts impact, influence that energy and push it into a better space. I have to believe that. Because look at all the beauty. If you just stop looking at the idiocy on the phone or TVs or the propaganda that's everywhere, just get your head out of that and just walk outside. Look up. Watch a bird. It's so immense. Thank you for being here. I'll see you in the next one. I hope so. I hope you'll be here. Use the comments. Tell me what you think of my mandala idea. Have I talked about it too much? Would it be useful to do a short series, even if it's just one video, on Nichiren's mandala or the true mandala? Something. I'm not trying to find clickbait. I'm trying to find a title that, if that's a question, you can easily find it on the channel. Right? I think we're probably past 800 videos on this channel. So you can't sit here and just scroll through, right? You need to be able to search it. So give me your ideas. What do you think? And questions about the mandala. It's important that we all understand what the deal is with this mandala, yeah? Take care of yourselves. I'll let you go now. I'll see you. Bye for now.